think we can all agree that nobody wants to start their day with whatever health beverage Minnie Castavet is cooking up in her actual Hell's Kitchen. No, I think I'll stick to a cup of coffee. And Satan knows I would sell my soul for a good cup of coffee. But I don't have to. I just have to switch to Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this exceptional coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. You can order coffee as you need it or take advantage of Sparkplug's autopilot, set it and forget it delivery. You will taste the difference. And right now, Sparkplug has a special offer for Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. This can apply to any size order and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? The time has never been better to start making the best coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
A hearty hiya to all you crazy cats who jive on motion pictures, and we thank you for throwing the next 125 project into your ears. We did cover all the AFI's Top 100 Greats from the 1998 and 2007 lists of great American movies, so now we tackle a little of this and a lot of that. Spoilers, they're coming. I'm the lover of barely cooked meat who does whatever my eccentric neighbor says, Ryan Ellis, and here's the talented young actor who will do anything to catch that big break. Anything! My wife, Bev.
That's me.
So the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Rosemary's Baby, the last movie in Scary Movie Month. Let's see how good people's memories are about our podcast. Now that we're covering Rosemary's Baby today, how many of the top 30 movies on the Thrills list have we not reviewed?
Just two.
Mm-hmm.
The Exorcist, which is number 3 on the list.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to get this wrong. I think number 27?
28.
28 on the list. Fatal Attraction we also haven't covered.
You're right, and The Exorcist would be the 45-year anniversary if we had done it this year, but you're not a big fan, and we can do it some other time, I suppose.
We'll do it someday. I just think that we're going to disagree about it, and that's all. I have an unpopular opinion about The Exorcist.
I love the movie, but it ain't perfect. And incidentally, we've covered 70% of the entire Throws list now. I looked at it. It's about 70 or 71, I think it is, of the top 100 on that list, and obviously 28 of the top 30. Okay, so Rosemary's Product of Rape was very much nominated for the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100s, but the devil didn't make the AFI put it on either list. It was released by Paramount a little over 50 years ago in June 1968, and it succeeded handsomely. But since the movie is 50 years old, Bev, you probably should remind people what it's about with the skinny.
Mia Farrow is docile New York housewife Rosemary Woodhouse, and John Cassavetes is her husband Guy, a struggling actor. Unbeknownst to Rosemary, the young couple's attempt to conceive is aided by none other than Satan himself, with the help of their imposing neighbors and Guy, who has traded Rosemary's pregnancy to Lucifer in exchange for help with his acting career. Rosemary spends the next 9 months in various states of pain, discomfort, paranoia, and finally a panic, as the reality of her situation becomes clear to her.
Or, in a nutshell, if ever there was an argument for a woman's right to choose, it is this. Although she wants the baby, and she doesn't know what's actually inside of her until it is out and has been out for a little while. But still. Okay, so Rotten Tomatoes numbers. 99% of critics. 99! 68 fresh, only one rotten, and 87% of audiences, and also Stanley Kubrick was a big fan. One of his movies, one of his great movies, was out this same year, 2001 A Space Odyssey. And neither of these got nominated for Best Picture. I was just looking at this only a few minutes ago. The nominees were weak that year, and one of the worst movies that ever won Best Picture, Oliver, which I've only seen once, so maybe it's not that bad, but I don't remember anything about it. It wasn't worthy as far as I'm concerned. The only movie in the Best Picture nominees of the five that I actually thought was a worthy film, although some of them may have been fine, but I just don't remember them that well, was The Lion in Winter.
Yeah.
So had it been The Lion in Winter, Rosemary's Baby, movie. 2001, much better class than was actually in that group, I would say. Rosemary's Baby was also eighth in 1968 at the box office. 2001 was number one. Funny Girl and The Love Bug were also big hits that year. So what a diverse group that is. It covers almost every basis with those four movies alone. This is the rare city-dwelling devil movie. Most in this genre take place in the country, because then you've got isolation. But here we are in the middle of New York City, the Dakota Building, John Lennon's building, where he lived, and then outside of which, where he died. What a shame that was, of course. Fuck you, Mark David Chapman. But anyway, what did you think of your, I'm guessing, second viewing of Rosemary's Baby?
Yeah, this is the second time I've seen it. I really want to like this movie more than I do. I enjoy it intellectually, and I appreciate its place in Hollywood, particularly New Hollywood. It's like on the cusp of where Hollywood really changed.
Yeah.
It's one of the first and best examples of one of my very favorite kinds of movies, which is a thoughtful psychological horror film. But it just never gets under my skin. I've seen it twice now, and while I enjoy it, it leaves me completely unscared and unmoved.
I am surprised at how unscary this movie is for what is a horror film. It is psychological horror. It is, or was, ninth on the Thrills list. Psycho is number one, by the way. We'll get that out of the way right now. Ninth, huh? Just yeah. Like The Birds being, I think it was sixth. The Birds has more thrills and more scares than this does, but both of them are not worthy of the top 10.
What is the thrilling scene? And I get that there's a climax at the end, and there is something with her hysteria at the end of her pregnancy.
Her eyes, maybe, are the big part of that, plus the rape night.
Mm.
Her eyes at the end where it's the, what have you done to its eyes? Her eyes, I'm saying, that big scene. Mia Farrow's
or
got
the rape scene where she says, this isn't a dream, this is real. Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, that was quoted by the AFI, one of their nominees for the quotes list. Didn't make the list. The line was, this isn't a dream, this is really happening. But the quote should be, AFI gets this wrong so often on their actual online thing. This is no dream, this is really happening. I know it's minor, but quote the fucking line properly. You're saying it's one of the great 100 lines or great 400 lines. But okay, back to the overall theme. I agree with you. The movie's not bad. It is definitely a thumb up. It's absolutely worth talking about, and it should be seen by anybody who's a horror movie fan or just a movie fan in general. Mia Farrow is wonderful. Another example of a film that you look back and like, how did she not get nominated for an Oscar? Jimmy Stewart in Vertigo, which maybe you didn't agree with, but I think is an obvious one. And the whole long list of movies where you think, what the fuck? How did they not nominate this?
How was she not a big star? I know she's a household name, but I feel like it has more to do with her private life and that she's always managed to stay in headlines because of her relationships and her scandals. Whereas, what other great movies did she really make?
She was in a bunch of Woody Allen films. It was at least 10, maybe even 12 Woody Allen films, I think it was. It was a lot, anyway. And some of them weren't great, and some of them were at least pretty damn good. They were never huge hits, but that was her cachet after this film. The irony is that her husband at the time, because Woody was never her husband, but her husband at the time of this movie was Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
And then he served her divorce papers on the set because she was making this movie. There's probably more to it than that, but that's the story they talk about on the making of. And then Robert Evans, who ran Paramount and just had started running Paramount around this time, this is one of the movies that helped that studio come back because they were in the doldrums. They were awful. They were the last of all the studios. This and Love Story and then The Godfather and so on as we got in the 70s really helped them out and brought them back. But Evans showed Farrow some footage and said, if he wants to divorce you, fuck him. Let him divorce you because you've got a career now. We could look through her whole resume. We could take a minute here and go through that. But it's really just Rosemary's Baby and the Woody Allen films. And she was good in a lot of those.
And maybe she's beautiful. I think she's such a pretty woman.
But why wasn't she, or hasn't she always been such a big star? She's got a small role. Well, she's not a really small role, but the nanny in the remake of The Omen, which is over 10 years ago now too, anyway. That's interesting because, of course, that's a link to this film. The Omen from 76 or The Omen from 2006 has a link to this kind of film. The Exorcist, obviously, too. You get these religious horror movies. It was a bit of a thing back in the late 60s and through the mid-70s. Beyond that, unless you're a buff like Quentin Tarantino who can name everybody's movie they've ever been in, what has Mia Farrow done? And it's maybe her own choice. Maybe she was more than happy to just be a quote-unquote housewife, not really a wife, of Woody Allen through the 70s and certainly into the 80s and into the early 90s.
She had a lot of children as well.
She's also a UN person. She's active in that. She's got causes and all that kind of thing. And now she's an older woman anyway, so she's probably semi-retired. But this is a great performance. Let's get back to the movie now because we got left topic here. Do you agree that no matter what you say about the movie, that this performance was award-worthy? Maybe not the Oscar itself, but at least in the top five, and she wasn't in there. The only Oscars this movie got, by the way, was supporting actress. And seeing it again, I wouldn't have given it to Ruth Gordon. But seeing the other nominees, I wouldn't have given it to any of them either. But I don't remember some of those performances, so maybe they were worthy. Ruth Gordon is a little hysterical and over the top. And she was known as a writer. She was an MGM person, I think it was. But anyway, she wrote those kinds of movies way back when with a writing partner, I believe, too. And she only hit, if you want to call it stardom, in the 60s and 70s. She's known for this, and she's known for Harold and Maude as an actress. Good in both movies, probably not so good in this, really, in retrospect. The only other nomination this movie got was for the adapted screenplay by Polanski, who was the writer-director. We didn't say his name yet. Roman Polanski. So much controversy. Roman Polanski, Mia Farrow.
So many little nitty-gritty turns we could take talking about this film. There's so much to talk about. But as far as Ruth Gordon's performance goes, I kind of agree with you. I think that her performance is really all writing and makeup and costume. She's a good actress, and everything around the movie kind of buoys her. She's such an interesting character. Certainly, she gets credit for some of that, but I think that anybody playing this role probably still would have been pretty interesting. I absolutely love Mia Farrow. A lot of people could have had the part Sharon Tate, Roman Polanski's wife at the time.
Who, a year after this movie came out, was dead.
Not just dead, but killed when she was 8 months pregnant. Well, and kid, she was killed, and the baby was killed. There's a whole curse associated with this movie, and all these terrible things that happened to people that worked on the movie, including Mia Farrow's pretty heartbreaking legacy, Roman Polanski's wife being killed along with their baby, and his own scandal, which has so many parallels to the plot of this movie, because
he is a rapist.
He's a rapist.
And the main plot line is devil rapes woman.
Not just devil rapes woman, devil rapes drugged woman. Roman Polanski drugged a 13-year-old girl and raped her.
Right,
and for the record, this is not allegedly. He did it. He admitted it. He confessed to it and then fled the country when he was on bail or whatever.
I've looked at some Oscar speeches. I've done this lots over the years. And when I recently saw the one where Polanski won, there was no speech. He wasn't there. So it was that he won the award for The Pianist. Harrison Ford accepted on his behalf. Harrison Ford had worked with him on Frantic many years before. So it seemed like it was a, hey, my friend here. Standing ovation. I remember Martin Scorsese, who was nominated against him that year.
Not everybody stood.
But a lot of people did. And in retrospect, watching that, it did make me feel a little bit weird.
Yeah.
But I also find it hard to judge the movie so much. Seeing him rewarded for the Oscar, I can judge that a little bit more. But watching Rosemary's Baby or Chinatown, Repulsion. Have you ever seen Repulsion?
I've never seen it. No.
You really got to see that movie. I thought about us doing that a couple of years ago, in fact, and I just let it slip by the wayside. There are so many ties between Repulsion, Rosemary's Baby, and a movie that you own, that you brought into the marriage, The Tenant.
You know what, though? Somebody lent that to me and I've never watched it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I feel terrible. It's like one of those things, every time I look at it, I feel guilty because it's not my copy of The Tenant. Somebody lent it to me and I just never was in the mood to watch a Polish Roman Polanski film.
But the whole point is the horror is happening in somebody's apartment building. And this does have a lot of ties with Repulsion. If you haven't seen it, we can't talk that much about it. You should see that movie. It's really good. Catherine Deneuve, who did some good things. Belle de Jour is probably the most famous thing she ever did. That's another good movie we should maybe cover one day. If you want to talk about Polanski's great films, of course, Chinatown is the most famous of all of them. The Pianist won on the Oscar, very good film. But Repulsion, it's not his best. Chinatown's his best, but Repulsion's way up there, and it has a lot of ties with Rosemary's Baby, with some really surreal stuff going on, too. Speaking of surreal, just like the kids singing and the birds, we covered that a few weeks ago, Mia Farrow's singing and the opening lullaby is eerie and unsettling. It's not supposed to be, because the whole point is she's lulling the kid to sleep. And we hear that in the very beginning, and we hear it at the very end. And it's funny, too, that the movie's called Rosemary's Baby, because if you didn't know what was going to happen, there was a book, Ira Levin wrote that a few years before this, which, by the way, he thinks this is the best adaptation of any book ever.
Apparently, it's an incredibly loyal adaptation.
Because Polanski didn't know, you can go ahead and change things.
The rumor is that Polanski thought he was obligated to cover it exactly, so a lot of the dialogue is pulled directly from the book, even.
Mm. But Polanski ties it together with the singing in the beginning, and then, which isn't really singing at the end, I guess, is she? But she's accepting of this fact. Now, apparently in the book, they say, Hail Rosemary, mother of Satan! And she's mothering the baby. And from what I understood about what I was reading, happily. And in the movie, it's more a matter of, do this. And I think maybe you could argue there's multiple things going on, that maybe Rosemary is just playing it cool right then and there. Maybe she's lost her mind. I don't think she's gone over the dark side, at least not at this point. Maybe in weeks or months or years, she maybe could. But in that moment, and the movie has this, I guess that's a thrills list version of why this movie is on that list, is the ending, because she walks in this room with all these people just so banally worshiping Satan. And we never see the baby. Brilliant choice, including her saying, what have you done to its eyes? If you show those eyes, they can never live up to the way Mia Farrow sells that moment.
I think that Rosemary's chief characteristic is that she is complacent, she's docile, compliant. She is, in many ways, in 1968, what many would consider to be a perfect wife. She is a well-behaved woman. She fits right into the script, the plan that every woman should want to be a good housewife. She's pretty, she's slim, she was dying to be a mother. She takes care of their home, but she also has this childlike attitude. She completely concedes to Guy. He is the boss of the relationship. In many ways, he's the dad. The way he talks to her, the way he demeans her when he wants to get his way and he can just get angry and then that's the end of conversation. And he has this very paternalistic way of dealing with her. Part of the perfect casting with Mia Farrow is that she has these giant eyes. She has this childlike look. She's a waif. She's delicate. But best of all, she sells adult youth. I don't know how else to describe it.
She gets the pixie haircut in the movie, which I agree with Guy. She looked better with longer hair. But she looks even younger when she does that, and maybe that's why they did it, because she looks even more like a little girl.
And it's the haircut that they gave her. She says, Vidal Sassoon says it's the hottest look. She didn't pick it.
Oh, right. Yeah.
It's just another example of her conceding
to authority. His opinion, she did, but in her opinion, she still didn't even choose that.
They're so mean to her.
Meaning
Everybody
guy.
Is so mean to her about her hair. Just tell her it looks fine, you jerks. My point being, so then at the end, when she accepts the baby into her life, part of that is just that she's in a room full of people telling her this is what she should do, and she spent her whole life being compliant. She's also spent her whole life at the mercy of these authority figures, be it her father at one point in her life, obviously Guy. Her success is very much attached to his success, and to every paternalistic figure in the film, especially the doctors that she deals with. So now she's in a position where her son is the son of the devil. If she hitches herself to this wagon, then imagine all the ways it will benefit her. The way being married to a successful husband would benefit her. There's no way she could improve her life on her own. She doesn't have the authority. She doesn't have the autonomy to do that. I really do believe that the movie is making a comment about this kind of woman and about paternalism and femininity and the harms in that vulnerability and how people take advantage of the role that women are expected to fill. Which is, of course, ironic considering that Roman Polanski is a rapist.
Which he wasn't then, but he became later, of course. And she married a guy who she's accused of being a child molester.
Yeah.
Well, again, didn't marry, but you know what I'm saying, with Woody Allen. I guess this is more in the book. I forget if it's mentioned in the movie, but I did read this online, so it must at least be in the book. That Rosemary's estranged from her parents for marrying a Jewish Protestant guy, and that would be the Guy character.
Is he Jewish or Protestant?
I wrote them both down, so I think that they're supposed to be their both. Well, anyway, she's Catholic, so if he's Jewish or Protestant, none of that counts compared to the Catholics, because that's where her parents would have felt about it. So she's already been made to feel guilty and responsible all through her life, so why wouldn't she continue doing this anyway? And you've talked about the patriarchy in a lot of our podcasts. Obviously, that applies, especially in the 60s. She's got a role to fill. She's had a baby. It's the son of Satan, for fuck's sakes. Which is a cliche. You might say that about Dennis the Menace, for God's sake, or Bart Simpson, or Eric Cartman, but now here is the son of Satan. Should she have to take care of this baby? No. But the movie is probably speeding up a process that some women might go through. I'm asking a lot of any woman or any man, for that matter, to accept what they've been told is this. But then again, I think the movie is literally saying at the end that it's supposed to be the son of Satan.
Yeah,
it is as plain as it gets.
But what's wrong with his eyes? He has goat eyes.
But you could argue this woman is insane, that she's lost her mind completely. But then does she imagine the rape? She says it's really happening. She could be wrong about that. But then the next day after it's happened, Guy is covering up that, yeah, I did that. Yeah, that's me. It's still a fucking rape, asshole.
Yeah,
she was not conscious.
Which was technically not illegal in 1968 to rape your unconscious wife. And she has this initial reaction. She's like, well, that's not cool. And he's like, yeah, whatever, baby, it's fine. And then she gets over it. Every woman in the world watching this movie would, like me, just turn inside out with cringy discomfort.
Did you notice that Guy can't face her after he's pipped her out?
Totally.
Because she's unclean, and it's because of him.
Well, he feels probably a little bit guilty about what he's putting her through, I should hope.
Very important moment where they show all these people who are naked. You do see some boobs, you see some butts in this movie, so it earned, it must have had an R rating, I should check that, but I'm pretty sure it had an R rating. But he's standing there talking to Minnie, and saying something about, is this really necessary? Yes, it is, for the ceremony. What the hell the dialogue is.
You know what's great? They're
but
like,
he's right there with her.
Do you mind, what do they say? Do you mind the music? And what does she say? She's unconscious, sort of naked. She's taking part of this ritual. She's probably confused. And what does she say? No, don't change the music. Don't do it
You're
on account
she,
of me. Rosemary.
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 Okay.
Another great example of her docility. Mm. Is that a word? Docility?
It is
I
now.
Just make it up?
We just talked about them being naked, but the first time we see the cast of vets, they are dressed sharp.
Surely.
Colorful outfits. We've heard about them before. We've heard them through the walls. Love that touch. You and I both live in apartments. Sometimes you hear people through the walls doing the simplest of things, just blowing their nose or breathing sometimes. You had a neighbor that was
the
easy
cough.
To hear. Yeah, he would not even
every
just
morning.
Cough.
I also live next door to an opera singer. That was wonderful. I got to hear her practicing all the time.
Right, but that's an example of something that you would not be able to miss. But sometimes in apartment buildings, you hear everything. I've heard people fuck. I've heard people fight. I've heard people walk. I've heard people, like I said, breathe. And this movie really captures that moment. Taxi Driver and Raging Bull, two great Scorsese movies, both get those things. We talked about in those podcasts we did so long ago. Where in the infamous, such a famous scene, you talking to me, you hear his neighbors talking, living their lives. Raging Bull. He fights with his neighbors. Rosemary's Baby gets that same kind of thing. And, of course, it was before the Scorsese movies anyway, where you hear what's happening. And this is a posh building, but then it's still an old building, so you're going to hear things through the wall, even when it's really rich and cool and all that. By the way, how do they afford that building when he's a struggling actor?
For the record, I would sell you to Satan for an apartment like that in Toronto, let alone Manhattan.
Even in the 60s, it was incredibly expensive, I'm sure. I guess he's a landlord, but that's Elisha Cook Jr., who we've covered plenty of times, the Maltese Falcon and Shane. He's the one that gets killed by Jack Wilson. The first time Jack Wilson kills somebody, the guy who challenges him gets killed in the mud. Is he part of the thing at the end? I forget now. Do we see him later on, anything like that?
I can't remember.
Because Charles Grodin is her supposedly good doctor, Dr. Hill.
A Satanist. He's just a misogynist like the rest of them.
Okay, so that is it, right? Because this was Grodin's big break in movies. He's good in a lot of things. You gotta see Midnight Run, of all things. We've covered a lot of 1988 movies, so we won't cover this, but we should at least watch Midnight Run before the year's over. He and De Niro, really good together. One of Grodin's best performances. But you're saying he was not involved. Is he not in the apartment at the end either?
No, I don't think so. I think it's like the great turn in the movie that she finally gets Guy to... Or no, she just goes sees the doctor. Guy doesn't want her to see Dr. Hill because... He doesn't want her to see anybody, not in the coven.
Ralph Bellamy is the doctor she's been going to all this time.
So she finally makes it to the good doctor, and she tells him the whole story. Now, of course, as a viewer, you suspect that no doctor in his right mind would take her story at face value because it's completely batshit insane. But he listens to her calmly, and you are falsely lulled to believe that he might actually take care of
her. Finally, somebody's going to help this woman.
Someone's going to help this woman. Actually, he, just like everybody else in the world, treats her like a child who can't be trusted even in her own mind, calls her husband. I don't think it would happen now. It actually gave me Mad Men vibes. There's a scene like this in Mad Men where Betty Draper is seeing a shrink, and the shrink immediately after the session calls Don Draper and tells him everything that he discerned from their session. This total violation of privacy and boundaries.
Nice connection, because both husbands don't, in the end, really care that much.
No.
They shouldn't know what they were told, but they don't even care about what they were told.
They're terrible husbands, both of them. But then, yeah, Dr. Hill, even though he's not in on the plot, he still sends Rosemary right back into the arms of her abusers.
And Ralph Bellamy, who we covered in The Awful Truth and His Girl Friday, he's been in some John Landis flicks, where it was, I guess about 30 years ago now, always the second banana, but he's one of the more seemingly normal people in this cult, certainly compared to the cast of Etsy, he seems normal enough anyway, but he is part of the whole plot, and when you see him walk into Dr. Hill's office, your heart sinks.
And I think one of the important details of the film, and that was appropriate for the times, is their depiction of how Rosemary trusts these men for a very long time. She trusts her husband.
Wouldn't you?
Her doctor. Well, I have a pretty natural trust in authority, and I trust you, but we're in a different generation, and I think there's a point where if you were talking to me and treating me the way Guy treats Rosemary, I would probably be able to recognize this as
not like me, the
an
doctors.
Unsafe situation.
Wouldn't you trust the doctors?
Oh, yeah, I would trust the doctors. I'm totally the type of person who trusts authority figures that completely. But then that's that much more of a crime, that she's given her agency up to these people. Instead, they exploit her. Every last one of them is exploiting her. And it's this tragic betrayal of a trust and a warning to women like Rosemary, who is, by 1968 standards, a good woman. This movie came out, and the book too, on the eve of the Summer of Love. The world was changing very quickly. Squares were all afraid of all the free love hippies. Yes, and the threat that these people presented to the status quo, right? And I think a lot of people were probably saying at the time that the devil was at work.
Aquarius. Continue.
Yet, it is the compliant, docile Rosemary who's actually vulnerable to the devil. Throughout the film, Rosemary is nothing but perfect, accommodating, complacent. She does everything a woman of her generation is supposed to do, but she is the one who gets screwed by the devil, literally and figuratively. Yeah. Not like the hippies of the time.
Devil's Advocate has a scene where, I don't think you see it happen, but Al Pacino describes it later about, on a scale of 1 to 10, it was a, I don't know, a 15, or it was a 15 or something, he says. don't think you see that in Devil's Advocate, but you're seeing enough evidence in this movie that the devil's really doing it, and it's pretty awful. Guy has the right instinct about his neighbors, by the way, early on. He wants to avoid the elderly, nosy neighbors, and it's Rosemary he wants to have dinner with them and get involved with them. The Castevets have a plan from the beginning, obviously. But the dinner with the Castevets is just to size, well, I guess both of them up, but really to seduce Guy.
Yeah.
Seducing her is not the point. We're going to drug her. Fuck her. She doesn't matter. We got to convince this guy. Now, the two plays he'd been in, which are mentioned more than once by Rosemary, I think, well, maybe between her and Guy, Luther and Nobody Loves an Albatross.
I love how she says it often enough that it becomes this weird mantra, and you understand that she's trying to make him look good, trying to big him up.
Or like in A Few Good Men, where Cruz asks Demi Moore, why are you always giving me your resume? She's always giving people his resume. By the way, his name, Guy, this had to be deliberate by Ira Levin. Just a generic name like Guy, as if he doesn't matter. So she doesn't matter in a way, but she's also the most important thing. You know what I'm saying? We got to seduce him so he's pinnacle. But once we've seduced him, then he's fucking irrelevant. And as much as we don't actually respect her or care about her or like her, she's pinnacle. The funny thing about all that, though, is that she suffers for months and months and months. Don't they want baby Satan to be healthy?
Well, they don't care if she's healthy, and I guess part of it is
But if she died, then the baby's going to die. Here's another movie. We talked about this in The Witch, about how you have to sign a contract. Who upholds contracts in these kinds of stories? Same with this. Why does she have to do things exactly the way she does them, and why you have to go through this procedure?
She has to have the tannis root and the health drink.
The Omen follows these same kinds of things. The Exorcist has all these rules for these evil creatures that they're actually going to follow. Who the fuck's going to enforce them? They reject God, yet they actually listen to God, I guess. I don't really know.
And Satan has these strict rules they have to follow. I feel like Satan would be a little more lax.
So Guy wants a career, but he sells out his wife just to get a gig. The funny thing is that he's a bad actor, but his role in this devil-worshipping stuff. Now, maybe that's for the movie's benefit. The movie's long. It's way over 2 hours.
Yeah, it's too long.
So maybe it's shorthand to say, we have to know that he's in on it. The movie doesn't really have a big twist. It sells that Rosemary's baby is going to be Satan's baby, and it is. There's no big twist in this movie. And Guy's part of that. So maybe if it's all about that she's surprised he really is, or more so that we are surprised that he really is, because we're not surprised that he really isn't on it.
It could have had a Get Out twist, where we know something's up, but we don't know if he's in on it or not until the end, and then it's...
Allison Williams is not the greatest actress in the world, but that moment with the keys and Get Out is the best thing she's ever done in her life. And John Cassavetes is a good actor. He was nominated the year before for The Dirty Dozen, so he had been at the awards before. Maybe he didn't go to the awards, I don't know, but he was an Oscar nominee. He was a director of his own distinctive films. I think he wrote them as well, often starred in them. So he'd been in the business for a long time as an actor and all these other things. And here he is in this big budget film. And I think the point was, let me make the money from this movie and put it into something else. I don't think it really stands out. And that's probably partly the point. Jack Nicholson, Warren Beatty were up for this. Nicholson certainly wasn't a star at this point. Easy Rider the next year is what made him a star. Warren Beatty was. Robert Redford was talked about, but he had a contract dispute with Paramount, so that's why he wasn't in it. Redford would have been a very interesting choice, actually.
I agree. I would have loved to see him.
And he was more of a star then. As I said, Beatty was, Nicholson was not. But maybe in a way it's best that you get the independent actor, director guy in retrospect. They didn't really know that then, that he wasn't going to become some power player in the business. Not to discount John Cassavetes' role in Hollywood, because he has a very important role in independent film. But he is the outsider in this movie, and he's the outsider in this business. And if you'd had Nicholson, Beatty, Redford long term, we didn't know this then, they're the insiders as well. So there's another wrinkle on top of this as well.
I would have loved to see a blonde, handsome, all-American guy who isn't getting everything he wants and then feels entitled to sell his wife literally to Satan.
So Redford then.
To get what he wants. Yeah, I would have loved to see that. John Cassavetes, though, I think is great. And what he has, what he brings to the part, is a tremendous amount of charisma. He's a surprisingly charming guy, and I feel like I get why Rosemary puts up with his shit.
I don't.
Because when he's turning on the charm, he's cute and funny, and they have this nice rapport with one another.
Okay, I didn't really see that the same way. Fine. I'm not saying he's bad.
How do you see it? How do you see it? I'm curious.
I thought I just said, I don't think that the actor, or maybe it's the role, maybe it's written that way, that he conveys much of anything. Because once they've convinced him to sell it his wife, he doesn't matter. That's why he's called Guy. So had it been these other classic legendary actors, and Cassavetes was good, but Nicholson, Redford, Beatty, maybe they wouldn't have been any better either. And it's not like he's bad, but his co-star is better than him. And even though I criticized Ruth Gordon a minute ago, I can't deny there's charisma, but she's given some ridiculous things to do and to say. And when you know where the movie's going, and I've seen the movie probably 3 times now, maybe even 4 times, I'm seeing the strings, if you will. Sydney Blackmer plays Roman Castevet. I like that touch, by the way, as Scrabble fans, of course, we're board game fans in general, but when she figures out the name, oh, I'm drawing the blank what the actual name was.
I can't remember
the old name, but it ends up being Roman Castevet, so that's a nice touch. Maybe that's
it's
in the novel.
It's an anagram. That seems kind of corny the way it sets up. And on his deathbed, he said, it's an anagram. Okay.
Oh, true. But I do like the way she figures it out using Scrabble. That was a nice thing.
Mm-hmm.
That one she figures out from is Hutch, her old friend. Maurice Evans. We covered Planet of the Apes a long time ago, and he is Dr. Zaius.
Oh my God, really?
Mm-hmm. You can sort of hear the voice. Okay, so the dream sequences, we see a few of them. They're very creepy. That's probably one of the reasons the movie got the nomination. Well, made the top 100 thrills list, the top 10, in fact. Including the night she gets raped, you see some dream sequences. She dreams of the Pope and being forgiven by him while being raped. Ooh, okay. What did you think of the night when she is fucked by the devil? It was a 15, to quote Pacino, whatever the number was that he gave in Devil's Advocate. They make it literal then, and by the end of the movie, we know it was literal. I'm the one that always speculates that maybe it wasn't real, maybe the person's insane. And you could argue that Rosemary's gone nuts, but this movie doesn't really leave that open the way that so many other films we've covered, like Taxi Driver, the very ending, isn't real. I think this movie is saying, this is real, and it always was.
Well, that scene lays it out. Without that scene, you could actually cast doubt about whether she's imagining things and being paranoid. But because that scene is there, then we, the audience, know Satan raped her. She's pregnant with Satan's baby. And everybody around her is in on it. And they're lying to her. Even the fact that Guy is in the room with them, naked with them, chanting with them. So everything's laid out right in that moment, and it's just a matter of watching her. And maybe that's why the film seems to be missing tension. I've never felt it. I get it intellectually. It's never given me any feelings, and maybe I would be far more invested in it if I was wondering the whole time if she was imagining things.
Show that
or not.
As a flashback in the last 5 minutes of the movie.
Have a dream sequence that's far more vague, and there's this really great imagery. Like you say, the Pope, it's kind of a famous shot of the bed floating in the ocean.
Mm.
You can make it much muddier, and then it's just a cause to wonder, did she just drink too much and have wacky nightmares? Who knows?
Good thing Satan was potent, because otherwise you have to keep raping her and raping her and raping her until one of those little guys got through.
Well, they did make a point to say that, A, this is when they knew she would be fertile, judging
no,
by her cycles.
Him. Is he fertile?
He's Satan. If he wants to be fertile, he's fertile.
He has to follow the rules of all mankind by fucking at the right time and with contracts.
I love the line she has when she wakes up and she says, I dreamt that I was being raped by a demon. And Guy's response is, hey, thanks a lot. Oh, everything about his behavior is so manipulative, but it also feels so authentic, like what a shitty dude would say to his wife or girlfriend. You know, like anyone has ever dated a shitty person who tries to convince you that they're not shitty, you're crazy, you're overreacting. There's just so much truth in this film when it comes to that power imbalance or that exploitation of her.
Rosemary's pregnancy is awful. We see a lot of that in the movie. I think that Mia Farrow lost weight. She seems like she gets a little bit skinnier and whatnot.
Some of
she's
it
already
is makeup,
small.
Yeah.
Makeup certainly helps, of course. The different haircut makes a difference. She does eat raw meat. Do pregnant women crave raw meat? I don't know. You wouldn't know. Mia Farrow was a vegetarian. I read somewhere that she had to eat raw meat, barely cooked. She puts a little piece of steak on the fryer for seconds, flips it, seconds, takes it off there and eats it right away. And she also eats raw chicken hearts or something early on.
Or
in the
liver
film.
Or something, yeah.
Kind of like Leonardo DiCaprio ate raw bison heart or something like that.
Yeah.
For his Oscar win in The Revenant.
He's also a vegetarian.
A strict vegetarian. Yeah. So, A, why are the directors doing this to these guys? Couldn't you fake it? We don't fucking know what the guy's eating or what the woman's eating.
Crying out loud.
She also walks into traffic, and she's walking into actual traffic. I am walking here! She walks in there, and Polanski's the one operating the camera. They're both in danger, but apparently he told her, oh, they won't hit a pregnant woman.
Just do it. They won't hit you because you look pregnant.
Reminds me of Bowfinger. One of the funniest scenes in that movie, even though it's terrible, is when they get Jif to run through traffic. Oh, heavenly God, oh, heavenly God. That was great. It was awesome. Now do it again. It's terrible what they do to him, but it's really funny. Love Bowfinger so much. Her problems during pregnancy are hard to watch. Obviously, that's deliberate. You're never going to get pregnant. You don't want to. We have no interest in having kids. Anyone who knows their podcast has heard us say that before. But as a woman, how did you feel about those scenes? Did they upset you? Did they bother you more?
Nothing bothers me more than the gaslighting, than the way nobody takes her seriously. because always we as the audience know that they're lying to her and they're using these cruel manipulation techniques to get their way with her, to shut her up, to make her defer doing anything about her situation. It's the exploitation of their authority and her trust in her bothers me way more than the pregnancy stuff. I mean, the pregnancy stuff is scary. Anybody who's ever had a pregnancy knows women died in childbirth a lot until there was modern medicine. If you don't trust your doctor, your life is at risk. And women still die in childbirth.
They're not always right.
Doctors are not always right, and pregnancy is actually an incredibly dangerous time. So when a woman is expressing concern, you should take her fucking seriously. It's so real, and it's the banality of evil, right? That it's just somebody dismissing a woman.
So it's powerful whether she's actually in a plot, which she is in this movie, or if they're just ignoring her and none of this plot was real. Either way, it's terrible.
Some people just ignore women's concerns because it's inconvenient. Mm. And that's kind of the impression that they're giving her, that she's being annoying. Don't be troublesome.
And I don't really think about Frank Sinatra as her husband, but he was a powerful person, a very strong person.
More than twice her age.
Bad implications, he's long dead, though, so maybe there's some kind of...
I mean, come on, he's 50
method acting
years old.
For her.
Yeah, he's 50 years old, he marries Mia Farrow when she's 21, makes her promise to give up her career, and then when she takes this chance-in-a-lifetime role, what does he do? He serves her divorce papers on set. That man was petty.
Yeah. Although, ironically, he supposedly said when Woody Allen was finally outed for being with Sunyi Previn, he said, "You want me to break his legs for you?"
Come on, let's face it. Ronan Farrow is not Woody Allen's son. I don't want to shock anybody here, but nobody in the whole wide world believes that Ronan Farrow is Woody Allen's son.
I don't know what you're talking about, Bev. He's spitting image of me.
If you look at pictures of Ronan Farrow and Frank Sinatra, although Ronan Farrow looks a fair amount like his mother, he's a very good-looking man, but he resembles Frank Sinatra a lot more. And somebody in an interview was like, "Hey, what's the deal with that? Is Frank Sinatra Ronan's father?" She's like, "Maybe." She didn't deny it.
This is after she divorced Sinatra and was supposed to be with Woody for
many
years.
But I guess they carried on an affair. Who knows what her and Woody Allen's relationship, but no matter how you slice it, they clearly had a very unconventional
relationship. They never got married legally. And
they never moved in together.
Never lived together.
But they had children together.
Yeah, they kept separate apartments. Which actually, before it all broke down, there was something very progressive about that and something honorable about that. It was something different. It seemed so grown up. And everyone seemed to respect Woody Allen so much. Then, of course, he lost so much respect when all came out that he had been with Sunyi. And what's happened with what she said since about her daughter and everything else. And obviously, when she married Frank Sinatra, that was not usual either, because she married such a huge star who may have had ties to the mob and God knows what else. Okay, back to Rosemary's Baby. One more note about the plot is that the baby, Rosemary's Baby, was born in June 1966. So that makes it 666.
Oh.
And I mentioned The Omen, which she was in the remake. That was released in June 2006. 666. No, 666. But anyway, a lot of sixes. And of course, The Omen from 76 was released, I think, in June, but 76. So a lot of sixes. They're very deliberate with those choices of when they release those movies. Patty Duke auditioned to play Rosemary. She won the Oscar a few years before, quite a few years before, actually, in The Miracle Worker. But she did play Rosemary in the sequel, which was called Look What's Happened to Rosemary's Baby, a TV movie in 1976. And the editor of this film, Sam Osteen, who worked on The Graduate and Chinatown, he directed Look What's Happened to Rosemary's Baby. He was co-editing on this movie, by the way, with Bob Wyman. And the movie's long, but it's not... Well, does it feel long? You tell me.
Yeah, it feels long.
Okay, yeah, fine. I guess it does, yeah.
It's too long.
There's not that much plot, actually.
Pacing, yeah.
For a movie that's 2 hours and 16 or 18 minutes long, there's really not that much that happens, is there? It's almost like it could be cut down to about
an hour
40.
I feel like there's like 20 minutes of them painting the apartment, buying furniture, and getting all nested in there.
Even though it's a nice touch, we talked about it when it happened. They say, "Let's have sex." And we see them get undressed. Now, we don't see their clothes come off because we never see them actually get naked. But we see him lay back and unbuckle and struggle to get
his pants
off.
They take their own clothes off. And it
takes him 45 seconds to a minute, it seems.
Utilitarian way, yeah. And they really show all the details of that. And we remark that, well, that's marriage right there. When you're falling in love with somebody, you tear each other's clothes off. But once you've been married, I'll take my clothes off, thanks. And you just do that first and then begin the foreplay.
Which maybe is why that was in there. And I like that touch, but then it also does take time to do all that.
they obviously intentionally included that because they wanted to establish that this is like an old married couple.
They're not old, though.
They're not old, but just like all those things about an established couple where sex is no longer something that is fiery and passionate anymore. It can still be wonderful, but it's not slamming against a wall and you're kissing and tearing each other's clothes off. It's, hey, let's agree to have sex right now. And then just mechanically take off their clothes.
The way you might pull out the cutting board and the knife to start chopping vegetables for dinner. Same kind of thing.
And having seen the apartment, when they look at it and then they make a point of showing that they painted, I don't think there is a more grotesque thing that happens in that movie than two people, renters no less, covering up all that beautiful wood detail with white paint. Get out of here. You are the monsters. You are the devils.
You brought this on yourself.
How could you?
When they're shown the apartment, is that not a long take? There's a lot of long takes in this movie, actually, and that's a great touch by a fairly new director. Polanski had made a few films. I mentioned Repulsion. It was before this. So was Knife in the Water. His composer, Christoph Komeda, composed Knife in the Water. The Lullaby, which you hear many times, Rosemary's Lullaby. It's in different ways, though. It's light sometimes, it's jaunty, it's freaky, and it's the one that everyone knows where it's Mia Farrow actually just humming it.
And the composer was a victim of the Rosemary's Baby's Curse because within a year of this movie, he hit his head, fell into a coma, and died. And before we move on from the apartment, I want to talk about how they shot the apartment. I think there's shot after shot that has these beautiful, effective, askew angles. There's all this claustrophobic. There's the very famous shot where Minnie is on the phone and she's obscured by the doorway. And famously, when it first aired in theaters, every person in the audience kind of like tilt to the right to try and get a better view of what was happening.
Which,
like,
is absurd, but that's what's absurd, so great about it.
It's just this involuntary thing. You're so curious about what's going on. You know that something's up, but it's obscure. There's a lot of that. It's really beautifully shot. I think if I was trying to make a movie about paranoia in any way, I would study the visual elements of this film, the visual language of this film. I couldn't put my finger on how he makes that place seem sinister, even though it's just a banal apartment.
Well, in that scene when I think it's Ruth Gordon who's on the phone, you can sort of see her, but you can't really. So it's that whole sort of, what is she actually doing in there? Why can't I see her? I don't know if it was Polanski or if it was a cinematographer, William Fraker. Somebody said, let's move the camera a little bit to the left. And we all do that whole sort of, well, I think I probably did it too. Maybe, I don't remember. But I know they talk about the documentary,
just
the making of.
To the right to try and get a better view.
I mean, that's not possible with the movie screen. Tony Curtis is the voice on the phone, which I didn't know until they talk about in the making of. I'm like, oh, right, that's Tony Curtis. Thank you, Flintstones. He's the guy who struck blind so Guy could get the gig. That was the voice on the phone for Mia Farrow to listen to. I don't know if I believe that one because it could have been any. It could have been a production assistant just talking to her. But I read that Mia Farrow was doing the whole sort of, I recognize this voice, where I recognize it from.
She was trying to place the voice. Like you say, it was probably a PA. And even if it was Tony Curtis's voice, you're going to let that affect your performance? I don't know.
Polanski was the writer and director. We talked about Repulsion, Chinatown, the pianist, and he's a rapist. He was supposed to direct Downhill Racer for Robert Evans with Paramount. But then I guess Evans either just bait and switched him in a good way, or I don't know what it was, but he ended up directing this instead. Do you think his direction was excellent? Should this have been award nominated that year? It was not. His script was, but his direction was not.
I guess unpopular opinion, and this has nothing to do with his personal life, there's an element of the movie that doesn't work for me, in that I find it boring, and that I'm just not invested in the characters. It's super interesting. It's a great movie when you're paying attention to it, but it's just not a movie I ever get caught up in. And I think that's his failure. I think that it was probably that he was too loyal to the book, so what works in a novel doesn't work in a film. And the running time is a problem.
Isn't it funny that the two classic movies we've covered in this month, the Scary Movie Month, one was 2 hours flat, this one's 2:15 or something. The two modern movies were an hour 30-something and an hour 40-something. The Witch and It Follows got in and got out, made their point, got the hell out of there. I said It Follows should have been nominated for its editing. Maybe The Witch could have been too. But definitely not with Rosemary's Baby and The Birds, because they are too damn long. The Birds takes forever to get anywhere. Rosemary's Baby doesn't take forever, because you do see relevant things like them seeing the apartment and all that kind of stuff. Sony movies today are so goddamn long, and you think of the old days, well, they didn't make movies like this unless they were a big epic like Lawrence of Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
But then they did make movies that were too fucking long that didn't really need to be. And a great comparison with movies we're covering in the very same month by novice filmmakers, Robert Eggers and David Robert Mitchell.
It's not necessarily about making it too long, but it is about pacing. there's an error in the pacing.
Is this deliberate pacing then?
It's just a misstep. It's the one thing that perhaps they just don't get right. I don't care if Rosemary's okay.
Okay.
I don't care about what happens to her baby.
You know who would have made a shorter film? William Castle. Schlockmaster. He was the producer. He was known for smell-o-vision and some other techniques back in this era. He was convinced the project was cursed, and he was also convinced not to direct the project, I think by Robert Evans. They wanted to get a more classy director, a more, I guess, reputable director. This movie would have been probably forgotten had he directed it. He let Polanski do what he did, I guess. I don't know how much sway Polanski had on the set as the writer-director, as a young guy, but he let him make his movie. Castle actually is the guy who said the phone booth and Rosemary's on the phone with Tony Curtis. So the movie's 185:1. We watched the inferior-looking DVD. We're not going to buy the Blu-ray because we're probably not going to watch this movie again. But it was pretty spotty. I mentioned Fraker shot it, Osteen edited, with Bob Wyman and Komeda composed. We talked about all those things. So let's get to the influence. I mentioned the TV movie in 1976, the sequel to this. This didn't inspire a franchise, though, like other occult classics like The Exorcist and The Omen. And I wonder why. Because it only got a TV movie 8 years later, nothing else. The Omen had a whole arc. The Exorcist has had so many things. Now it's got a TV series on Netflix.
And there'd be so many angles that you could take because you have Satan as a child, Satan growing up. You have all kinds of themes you could explore about
the
what
Omen
it would
that.
Actually be like to be the mother of Satan.
The Omen pays that off, but as the kid grows
exactly.
up. We talked about the awards and lists pretty extensively, but let's get a few more things near. It made the National Film Registry in 2014, along with Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Saving Private Ryan, and The Big Lebowski. We've covered all those movies. That's a weird group before, right there. I mentioned it was 9th on the Top 100 Thrills. It was nominated for the Top 50 Villains, Roman and Mini Castivet, but it's really just the whole group of them. They represent the whole coven of witches, I guess. Witches, but I'm back in the witch here, but
funny
the devil
thing,
worshippers.
It's the rare depiction of witchcraft as a distinctly male domain. Of course, Mini takes part, but there's no question that Roman is the patriarch of their coven, and Guy doesn't even seem to let Rosemary in on the plan at all. He merely takes advantage of her feminine biology to use her as a vessel for himself and his own witchcraft.
She's a cum receptacle for the bad guy. The ultimate bad guy. How about the last thoughts on Rosemary's Baby? Maybe not the best way to end our otherwise successful Scary Movie Month, because our two modern movies, well, one of them is set way back when, The Witch, but our two modern made movies, The Witch, and it follows, big thumbs up. The Birds, moderate thumbs up. Definitely appreciate a lot of things in it. We appreciate this movie too, but is it the worst of the four?
No, The Birds is the worst of the four.
Okay, fair. But this is still, I would say, and I think you agree, inferior to The Witch and It Follows.
Oh, yeah, it is. I may not love this film, but it is absolutely essential viewing. And if I were making any kind of domestic horror film, I'd be studying Polanski's techniques.
And you need to watch Repulsion to study those even more.
Well, then the case has been made.
That gets really surreal. The movie works the way I think they want it to, but yeah, I think you're right. I have to agree with you. I don't really care. But I'm sorry to say that about a woman who was, A, raped, but by Satan, and then has to raise Satan's baby.
And she's an actress that has so much pathos. All the ingredients seem to be there that I should absolutely be invested in her plight.
It's like a historical document. When you see the entranceway of the Dakota, you think, that's where that piece of shit gunned down John Lennon. And all the other things in this movie, there's probably a set. I'm sure that's really what we saw more often than not, was the actual sets.
I think the indoors were all sets. They weren't allowed to film inside the apartment building. They just used exteriors. But even in the idea of a historical document, you can watch a film and you can see the blueprint for all kinds of other movies that we love. You can see how this helped make those movies happen in the first place. So I have a tremendous amount of respect for the creativity, for the boldness that went into this film. But in the end, it leaves me cold.
But I'll sooner watch The Witch and It Follows.
Yeah.
Maybe fairly soon. It's certainly long before I'll watch this
Who
one
owe a debt to Rosemary's Baby, for sure.
So if you go the whole thumb up, thumb down thing, this is up, but kind of marginal, like The Birds was, I think. So when you hear us again in 7 days and nights, we'll be out of Scary Movie Month and into November, and it'll be one day before America's midterm election to decide whom Russia wants in Congress and the Senate. You all better vote. And we'll talk about that during Wag the Dog. All you Americans, vote, vote, vote. But a lot of you, it's not going to matter because it is so rigged. It's rigged.
But
it's
vote
rigged.
Anyway. But vote anyway.
It's rigged, all right. But it's rigged for a certain side. So anyway, we're going to get all political on your ass again like we did in Fahrenheit 9/11 by tackling the hilarious political satire, Wag the Dog. So the coming attraction is trivia for Wag the Dog. Dustin Hoffman's character in the film complains that producers don't get nominated for Oscars, but they do. It's for Best Picture. It's so weird that they would make that point. So first you need to know on whom Hoffman's character was based. Then once you figure that out, name the movies for which that real-life person was nominated for an Oscar for producing.
All right, so for the answer to that question, please check out next week's podcast about Wag the Dog. But what if you just can't wait and you need more Ryan and Bev in your life? Well, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts. While you're there, you can check out our entire roster. We've covered 280 movies, somewhere in that neighborhood.
We haven't, but the whole podcast is around that many.
Yeah.
I've got a number. I'll let you know when it's a 275. Nice number.
Oh, okay. We're close to 275. So many movies. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free, but perhaps in exchange for all of this great content, you could give us a rating and a review. And if in your review you mention a film that you would like to see covered, we will seriously consider it. And I mean that. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. You can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. And it is not case sensitive.
This isn't a dream. The end of this podcast is really happening. So end it.
And cut.